Psalm 27, starting at verse 1. Of David. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When evildoers assail me to eat up my flesh, my adversaries and foes, it is they who stumble and fall. Though an army encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war arise against me, yet I will be confident. One thing I have asked of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. For he will help me, hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will lift me high upon a rock. And now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me, and I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody to the Lord. Hear, O Lord, when I cry aloud. Be gracious to me and answer me. You have said, seek my face. My heart says to you, your face, Lord, do I seek. Hide not your face from me. Turn not your servant away in anger, O you who have been my help. Cast me not off, forsake me not, O God of my salvation. For my father and my mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me in. Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me on a level path because of my enemies. Give me not up to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me, and they breathe out violence. I believe that I shall look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord, be strong, and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord.
Well, good evening, everyone. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Christian. I'm a happy member of the church family here at St. Nick's. And I've had my last real enemy probably in grade 6. I can still remember his name, but I have no idea why we were enemies, but he felt very important at the time. Okay, so David introduces the theme of the psalm in the very first verse. He starts, the Lord is my light and my salvation, whom shall I fear? The Lord is my stronghold, the stronghold of my life, of whom shall I be afraid? So it's about God being our stronghold and about seeking refuge with God. It's not entirely clear when David wrote this psalm, but there's a similar one, Psalm 18, and a similar passage in 2 Samuel 22, if you want to take notes. And both of these are dated as on the day that the Lord rescued him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. At various times in his life, King David was literally surrounded by his mortal enemies. And there was King Saul who persecuted him. Then later was the rebellion of his son Absalom. There were the Philistines, there were the Ammonites. So David had lots and lots of enemies who literally wanted to kill him. One of the challenges with this psalm and with some of the other psalms in the Bible is that it's not always quite clear how we should apply them to ourselves. There are some that are very easy. So Dave did a fabulous job last week walking us through 23. And he said that 23 is one of those psalms that you can just take and pray and apply to your life. And this one is slightly more challenging. But I'm quite happy because there's some in the Bible that are even more challenging than this one. So very few of us, when we are sitting on a plane and there's a child kicking the back of our seat, would turn around and immediately quote Psalm 137 and say, blessed shall he be who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rock. We all know that that's not the kind of psalm that you can just take and apply to your life and quote whenever you feel like it. There's something that tells us that that wouldn't be appropriate. And so I guess the challenge is, what are we going to do about a psalm like this one that is kind of in the middle? So we all feel that we do have enemies, but then when we kind of press to think about it, quite a few of us will probably realize that our enemies don't seem quite as tragic as some of the other ones in the Bible. So when you look at why David has to seek refuge with God, he goes on, he says, "When evildoers assail me to eat up my flesh, my adversaries and foes, it is they who stumble and fall. And though an army encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war rise against me, yet I will be confident." There's a progression here, almost a classification of enemies. There's kind of the evildoers, just general. Then there's sort of enemies and foes who are specifically opposed to David. Then there's an army, so a great many enemies. And then finally, there's all-out war. And when I think about the people who complicate my life, I'm not quite sure whether they even make the list. So right now, very high on my list is our letting agency, who won't fix the leaking roof in our bedroom. But I'm not sure whether they're even evildoers, if I'm quite honest. And they've never expressed the slightest interest in actually eating my flesh. And so what am I to do about this? It's worth pausing to acknowledge that there are some Christians for whom this is very real. It's luckily uncommon here, but there's Christians in the world for whom waking up in the middle of the night to find the house surrounded by enemies is a very tragically real possibility. But we should also pause to acknowledge that despite all of our misgivings about the direction that the church is taking in this country, we're quite far away from that, and we should thank God for that. So what are we to do here? One idea would be, okay, we say, God can just be my stronghold, even though I don't really have any enemies. But if you look through the Psalms and other passages in the Old Testament where God is called the stronghold, then the enemy is never far away. The enemy is usually just in the preceding verse or just in the verse after. So again, if you feel like taking notes and looking them up later, Psalm 37, Psalm 94, Psalm 144, Proverbs 10 verse 29, or this passage in Nahum. "The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble. He knows those who take refuge in him. But with an overflowing flood, he will make a complete end of the adversaries, and he will pursue his enemies into darkness." So if you want to seek refuge, you first need an enemy. One way to think about this that I find very useful is to see the psalm as part of the greater picture of the book of Psalms and of the Bible. So when you go back to, I think it was the second talk of the series, Christian Stewart led us through Psalm 2. And in Psalm 2, we are first introduced to the anointed king of God, and it's made very clear that this is not King David, but this is King Jesus, because he's described as having been set up on Zion, God's holy hill. He's going to inherit the ends of the earth, and he's described as the actual Son of God. But we're also introduced to all the other kings and rulers of this earth who are plotting against the King of God. When Tom Bernardo invited me to do a talk, he sent us all a PDF, and one of the things in there was very helpful. So it's a dissertation by Matthew Searles, so I guess honor is due. And he gives a very helpful framework of thinking about enemies. He says, the word plot in Psalm 2:2 is a word meaning mutter, and it is used in Psalm 1:2 to translate as meditate. So the righteous meditate or mutter on God's law, and the wicked plot or mutter against the Lord and his anointed, rejecting his authority. This is the archetypal sin, dating back right to the Garden of Eden, where Satan encouraged Adam and Eve that life was better without God, so they should cast off his rule. You should also notice that the people plot against the Lord and his anointed, that is, against his king. Satan cannot attack God directly, so he attacks his wife's regions. During the Cold War, neither the United States nor the Soviet Union attacked and defeated each other directly. Instead, the whole Cold War played out as a series of proxy wars, kind of conflicts where each side would back some of the other kind of combating parties. And Wikipedia lists almost 60 of these proxy wars. And it's a bit similar. The actual enemy of Satan is God, but he cannot touch him directly. And so instead, he has to go for the next best, which in the case of the psalm was King David, as sort of the representative of God's people. And I guess by extension, we can see us now as the children of God and as his church as kind of the next best target that he has on offer. Satan cannot dethrone God. He cannot touch Jesus, but he can try to undermine our faith in him. And I find this a very useful way to think about this. So we can still read Psalm 27 and similar psalms if you kind of see it as part of this very big struggle that is playing out. And if we see it like this, we don't even need a physical enemy, as long as we understand that behind it is always the ultimate enemy of God. We don't even need to be surrounded by hostile people. Because if you look at the book of Job, for example, you see that Satan is using all sorts of means to try to undermine God. He's using sickness, he's using broken relationships, he's using bereavement. All of that because he can't actually touch God. It's the same way that the Apostle Paul writes it in Ephesians 6, where he writes, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers of this present darkness, against spiritual forces of evil in heavenly places." It's not a way that we're very familiar with thinking with, but I think it's a very helpful framework to understand psalms like this and sort of the concept of enemies in the psalms. Okay, so now that we have an enemy, now that we know that we're allowed to actually pray and use Psalm 27, let's see how we can actually seek refuge with God. David continues, and he describes how he seeks refuge with God. So in verses 4 to 6, he says, "One thing I've asked of the Lord, that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. For he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will lift me high upon a rock. And now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me." At the first glance, it looks like David is literally trying to hide in the temple, or rather in the tabernacle, the tent that was used to house the Ark of Covenant. And if you know a bit of history, there's some tradition of people fleeing into churches to get sanctuary and hiding there. Apparently, in England, you were legally safe from arrest between the 4th and the 17th century. Unfortunately for all of you, this is no longer the case. So if you decide to dabble in a bit of embezzlement this work, don't expect to come and get a coffee at the Wren and be fine again. Okay, instead of physically describing how to find refuge in God, David is describing how to spiritually find refuge in God. And there's kind of three pointers of how he wants to do this. If you look at verse 4, David starts, "One thing I have asked of the Lord that I desire." But it's not safety, and it's not that God would crush his enemies that surround him. But instead it's to be with God, even to see him, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. Jonathan Edwards said that what differentiates the nominal Christian from the true Christian is that the nominal Christian finds God useful. God can give him stuff. God can give respectability. God can provide stability for society. God is great to raise children. But the true Christian, above all else, finds God beautiful. It's a little bit like in the first Harry Potter book, where the only way to get the Philosopher's Stone out of the Mirror of Desire is if you don't actually want to use it. And so likewise, those who would only flee to God because they find him useful will not actually benefit from it. Instead, it's those who would risk their life to be with God who then find that he is their comfort and their shelter and their stronghold. I don't know how you feel about this. I find it a bit challenging. When I first thought about it, I was a little bit troubled because it raises the question, well, what if I actually need a stronghold? What if I actually need God's help? How can I be sure that I'm not just searching him because he's useful? But I guess the answer is actually very easy. I think the answer is just go and start seeking God now. And then when you need him, we already have found him. Second pointer, David longs to be with God and to see his beauty and to inquire in his temple. All the way through the Psalms, we see that what sets the people of God apart from the evildoers is that the people of God want to know God. In Psalm 1, they're described as someone whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. And on the other hand, in Psalm 14, we met evildoers who eat up my people as they eat bread, and what defined them was that they were fools who didn't want to know or understand God. In verse 11, David asks God to teach him. He says, "Teach me a way, O Lord, and lead me on a level path because of my enemies." So the way that we seek refuge with God is that we desire him, and this desire should lead us to want to know more about God and to understand him better. As a church family, this is one of the things that we really, really value. We want to help each other to better grow and better know God. And the best way to start is that after small groups in the summer, you just sign up for our regular small groups, and I would really highly encourage all of you to do that. Okay, and thirdly, as we desire God and as we learn more about God, we also learn to trust him more. Spurgeon put it like this. He said, "When faith turns to the Bible and reads the history of the Lord's people, she sees that God has been good to them, and knowing that he is the same yesterday and today and forever, she draws the cheering inference that he will also be good to her." God is our light and our salvation, our stronghold. When enemies, spiritual and physical, surround us, we can immediately turn to God and we can pray with David, "Hear, O Lord, when I cry aloud. Be gracious to me and answer me. You have said, seek my face. My heart says to you, your face, Lord, do I seek." We can trust God. Okay, final point. What kind of stronghold is God actually? Why should we want to run to God when we are in need of a stronghold? We can trust God because he's faithful and trustworthy, and we can trust God because he's a very, very powerful God. In verses 8 and 9, David asks God not to turn him away, not to forsake him. However, David makes immediately clear that the reason that he says this isn't because he actually fears that God will forsake him. Rather, he trusts that God is the only one who will not forsake him. If you look at verse 10, "For my father and my mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me in." If you've been in Christian circles for a significant amount of time, you know that this is the point where the speaker will traditionally tell you that he could never imagine forsaking his own children, and that if even he as an earthly father couldn't do this, how much less will God forsake his children? And that is very likely true. However, I have two issues with that. So the first issue, and by far the more serious, is that it's again worth remembering that there are some Christians for whom this is a reality. It's very rare in Europe, but there's a lot of places in the world where being cast out from your birth family, from your biological family, is very, 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 very real. And I guess it's worth praising God for the fact that this is not the case here. And at the same time, it's worth praying every once in a while for people who have trouble with their family because they are Christians. Now, my second point is significantly less tragic than that. It's that I'm not a father, and so I can't use this illustration myself. And so instead, you're now going to hear what happened after we crashed my dad's Prius. Karina and I got married when I was a lowly and poor PhD student, and when Karina was still training with the ambulance service. And after night shift, she couldn't come back with public transport because it was late in the night, and she was in a very rural part of Switzerland where buses would run maybe 3 times a day or so. So my dad, the most generous man I know, lent us his car. And it's worth saying that it was very much his car. It was legally his car. It just lived with us, and we occasionally fed it with some fuel. But my dad paid the registration and the insurance and absolutely everything else. Now, long story short, in a way that is very much our fault, we completely crashed the car. and even worse, for reasons that I won't go into, but that are, again, very understandable, the insurance company wouldn't actually cover it. So we were minus one Prius. I was a bit anxious what my dad would do and what he would say. However, to his really big credit, my dad didn't say a single harsh word. And instead, Karina and I had to work very, very hard to stop him from immediately buying us a replacement car. So at a time where any sensible person would question the wisdom of lending us any car, my dad would go and would buy us a new one after we crashed the previous one. I have the most generous father in the world. But, and here's the point, if even my earthly father didn't forsake me, how much less will my heavenly father? And final point, God is our stronghold. He will not desert us or cast us out. And he's a very, very powerful stronghold. He's a very powerful God. David says, I believe that I shall look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. It is very tempting to read the land of the living as just eternity at some point. And it's true that David was very convinced of the fact that he would spend eternity with God. But if you look at other places in the Old Testament where this phrase is used, it is almost always, I'd say it's always to contrast the land of the living, this world, as opposed to the land of the dead. So just one example here. There's a couple more in Ezekiel. And this one's from Isaiah. I said, I shall not see the Lord in the land of the living. I shall look on man no more among the inhabitants of the world. So the land of the living, at least in this passage and in all of the others that I looked up, it seems to be this world here, not sort of eternity. I think we're sometimes too quick to think that God will only ever help us spiritually. Yes, God does help us spiritually. He strengthens our faith. And we saw this in here. He fills us with joy, even in adversity, for example, in verse 6 of the psalm. But God is also the Lord of creation, the sovereign God who rules all creation. And he says in the psalms that whatever the Lord pleases, he does in heaven and on earth, in the seas and all the depths. David finds safety in God precisely because God can make his enemies stumble and fall. Indeed, throughout the Bible, sets apart the real God with a capital G from all the small g gods and the idols of the surrounding people is that he is the only real God who can actually hear prayer and then do something about it. For all the gods of the people are worthless idols, but the Lord made the heavens, Psalm 96, or Psalm 115. Our God is in the heavens, he does all that he pleases. Their idols are silver and gold, the works of human hands. They have mouths, but do not speak, eyes, but do not see. They have ears, but do not hear, noses that do not smell, hands, but do not feel, feet, but do not walk, and they did not make a sound in their throat. What sets God apart from all the false gods is that he is a powerful God who rules over all creation. It's very easy to think that because we can't bring anything to God, because the way that we seek him is spiritual, by desiring him, by reading his word, by trusting him, God will only ever help spiritually. Likewise, it's very, very tempting to think that he will only help us spiritually because God's aims are mainly spiritually. What God mainly cares about is that his name would be glorified, that we would trust in him and believe in him. But at the same time, the way that he brings these things about will sometimes be through spiritual means, through strengthening our faith and to give us hope. But at other times, it will be because he very, very practically takes care of us. And I think even though it's wise, if we want to distance ourselves from, I guess, the prosperity gospel people, it would be really, really tragic if we forgot to thank God and to praise him for all the many times where he practically provided us and practically came to our aid. God is a powerful stronghold, spiritually and practically. We've covered a lot of ground. We talked about enemies, and we talked about the fact that if we see the enemies in the Psalms as part of like the large cosmic struggle that the Psalms describes and that the Apostle Paul describes, we can still apply these Psalms to our lives. We talked about how we can seek God and how we can seek refuge with him through desiring him, through reading his word, through trusting him. And we talked about God as a stronghold, about the fact that he's powerful and about the fact that he will never forsake us. And so the only thing that is left to do is in verse 14. Wait for the Lord, be strong, and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord. Let me pray. Father God, we thank you that you are our life, our light, our salvation, and our stronghold. We thank you that you were a powerful refuge for King David. And we thank you that you will be a powerful refuge for us in our days of needs, that you will not forsake us, and that we can wait for you and for your salvation. Amen.